You are now listening to Bigfoot and Beyond, featuring the OG bad boys of Bigfoot, the Dr. Heckle and Mr. Jive of Squatchology, the Chip and Dale of Bigfoot, and I'm not talking about the cartoon. Please welcome your hosts, the Bigfoot celebrity couple, Biff Clobo, better known as Cliff Berrickman and James Bobo Fay.
Happy podcast day, Bobo. It's me again. You ready to do this?
Sorta.
Why are you not 100% down right now?
I got a little bit of upset tummy.
Oh, really? Okay.
Old chili.
I thought that was the old Bobes. I thought the new Bobes didn't eat old food.
I know, dude. I'm not supposed to. And
when you say not supposed to, is that a doctor's order or is it a girlfriend order or is it just common sense?
Doctor.
Okay. I was going to say. I've never known you to necessarily do much of what your girlfriend says, and common sense sometimes, well, not so common.
Exactly.
I remember I thought that as I can, Bobes, what are you doing, man? Because I have seen you eat some old food in my time, you know, like Finding Bigfoot days, and we'd be somewhere for 8 or 9 days, and there'd be piles of salad and things in a room. And I've seen you eat some things that I probably wouldn't have dared, but it was in Southeast Asia and Vietnam when you're eating all that street food. Yeah, that's what really made me go, dude, you got to, I don't know, man. What are you even eating?
I used to train for Mexico. I'd get a family-sized pepperoni pizza. Mm-hmm. I'd leave it on the counter. I'd eat like 2 slices a day. And then by the end of like the 6th day, it would be like pretty funky. But my stomach would growl a lot. I'd fart a lot. But then when I got to Mexico, I'd be fine.
So it was like training. It was like, like runners do in high altitudes when they have to race at high elevation.
Yep, it worked.
You're training your stomach, your gut, to be iron so it wouldn't reject the food in Mexico.
Exactly.
Now, you know, when I went to Mexico, I was camping on the beach down south of Laredo somewhere. Rattlesnake Beach, I think was the place. But we would just go to the fruit stand and buy produce and, you know, wash it off real well and everything. And that stuff never really got us sick or anything. Did you find in your time in Mexico that it was more dangerous to eat the vegetables or the meats?
Vegetables.
Really? Okay.
Usually.
Interesting.
Well, because they'd water them with, they'd water them with the water, and the water would have like E. coli in it or whatever.
That reminds me of the cabbage patches below the outhouses in Nepal in that small village.
Right. Yeah. Same thing. Yeah. The meat, yeah, you can get sick from the meat there for sure sometimes, but I never got that sick too often. Like, I mean, I had a few real bad bouts of food poisoning, but for all the time I spent there, I mean, I spent 6 months there 1 year. I had a couple bouts that time, but I was eating gnarly stuff.
But yeah, chili got you tonight.
Yeah, that stuff was pretty old. It was sitting in the fridge, but I didn't want to waste it. I paid like $6 for it, so I was like, I can't waste that, so I just ate it. So yeah, that was pretty cool. We had Prudon. I got some good feedback. A few people were like, kind of like, going, man, that guy used some pretty big words. And I was like, dude, he is very literate.
Yeah, that's the thing. And I said it a couple times, I think, during the podcast, and I'm not, you know, just blowing smoke or sucking up to anybody, you know, but he is one of the smartest guys in Bigfoot that I can think of. And I want to emphasize smart, though. I'm not saying educated, because he himself said he only has a small amount of community college or something like that. I don't think he has a degree, so education is not totally equal to intelligence. And I think Matt is a good example of what any one of us can do, no matter what educational level or access to education or anything that one has. You can be as smart as you want to be, and Matt is a great example, a shining beacon of that.
Yeah. And you said he just turned you on to a great new book, right?
Yeah. And you know, that's the secret to keeping on learning your entire life. Ask any elementary school teacher, such as myself, you got to keep on reading. And Matt just devours books, just devours these things. He turned me on to this Tiger book that I just came in the mail a couple days ago, so I haven't had a chance to get into yet. But he was talking about all the parallels between tigers and Sasquatches. And then this past week, he turned me on to this book. It's only available on Kindle, I guess, or Amazon, called Beyond the Secret Elephants, on Mystery Elephants and Discovery, by this guy named Gareth Patterson. I've only read about a third of the book so far, but it is outstanding. Just superficially, it seems to be more or less about elephants because that's this guy's expertise at this point in his life. He cut his teeth on studying lions and whatnot in the plains of Africa. But now he's studying these forest elephants in South Africa, the furthermost southern population of elephants anywhere, basically, because they're really just like on the very southern tip of South Africa and these forests that are down there. And they thought this troop, or no, not a troop, would be this herd of elephants was pretty much going almost extinct. They thought it was down to one individual, and then he shows up and kind of shows them all, no, they're not, there's way more than one. And he found all these elephants and talked to the local people who pretty much all knew that there were more than one as well. But along the way, as I said, this isn't just about elephants, but along the way, he started picking up stories of these things called Otung. And these are basically Sasquatches for all practical purposes. They are hairy humanoid critters in South Africa and in this forested foothills. And eventually over the years, he has observed them himself. And that is so important for a guy like this, a guy of this caliber, this award-winning, highly respected naturalist and ecologist and conservationist who has decades of field work study experience under his belt to say, yep, saw one. I talked to lots of the people I believe. They're real. They're here. And I'm going to write a book about it under the pretense of writing about elephants. But really, it's just as much about these things as it is elephants at all. So it's just such an amazing find. And it was published in mid-January 2020. That's like a month ago. This book's been out a month. When I started going through it, I said, holy smokes, this is an amazing book. So I texted Meldrum. I go, Jeff, check out this book. He mentions you. He's into the idea of relic hominoids, blah, blah, blah. And he wrote back, yeah, Ian Redman told me about it 2 days ago. I've already started reading it. Yeah, so this is the book to read, man. I think 2020, what a fantastic way to start the year, because this is going to be a very important work, just as important as Gregory Forth's work about the images of the Southeast Asian wild man. When people of these calibers start writing down what they learn and know and think on a piece of paper to share, that is significant. Because that makes us all smarter as a community. So I hope you read it. I hope all everybody listening reads it. It's fantastic.
Seriously, going to start tonight.
Yeah, and you can start whenever you hear this out there in podcast land too. Because again, it's only on Kindle, and I don't make any. We Bigfoot and Beyond. We don't make any money on this whatsoever. I am only suggesting it because so far I'm very impressed with it, and I believe when I'm done reading it, I'm going to look back and say that is going to be a historically important book in the subject. Bobo, you're also very well read in Bigfoot books, in particular. Are you aware of any other books that covers the idea of hairy hominoids in Africa?
I've seen some stuff on the internet about people, and I've gotten people have written to me about seeing things over there and hearing stories, but not much at all. And then I knew a girl or a young woman at Humboldt State University when she was getting her master's in wildlife. She went to Africa for a couple of years, and she saw two of them.
In South Africa?
No, she was up in Central Africa, like, or more like kind of Tanzania. Like, I think she was like North Tanzania. And they came into a glade, little clearing, and they were, I think she said, 4.5, 5 foot tall, at least 4.5, somewhere between 4.5 and 5 feet. She wasn't that far, she said, but they were bipedal, like some type of upright ape. She said you didn't think it was human you wouldn't think it was a wild man or something like that. She said she saw a pelt of one in the wildlife bush meat market. They were cracking down on bush meat markets over there, like primates, because of disease and stuff like that. And they thought she was like some undercover, like 60 Minutes reporter, like trying to expose because they had some of the meat from one. And she was trying to get it. They wouldn't sell it to her. And then they hid the hide because they were selling the hide for like $10 or $5 or something. She was trying to buy it, and they wouldn't sell it to her because they thought she was trying to bust them.
Well, that's kind of like the way the coelacanth was discovered.
Yeah, yeah.
Finding one in a fish market.
This was late 90s.
Very interesting.
Dude, I talked to a guy that worked down in the very bottom south end of Libya, There's some really dry hills out there, but he had an excellent couple settings of one down there at this oil facility. And he said like, there was no real forest anywhere nearby. Like it was a desert squat, like a, because there was a lot of canyons and there was a very few oases out there or springs. And he thought like, he goes, man, if you were down there trying to track one of those things, you probably wouldn't be that hard just because there's so little water.
Well, you know, if there anywhere in the world should have these things, it's going to be Africa.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, Southeast Asia obviously is a high contender as well, you know, but Africa should have them. And, you know, I've heard rumors and stories that I haven't spoken to any firsthand witnesses like you have directly, although I'd love to. I've seen a few newspaper odds and ends. In fact, I can probably look it up on my computer right here and take a look at that. I think I have one on my computer. And, you know, that the Relict Hominoid Conference that was scheduled for maybe a year or two ago that got canceled, that was supposed to be in South Africa, if I remember right. So, yeah, there's stuff going on there. Just, you know, but you know how in a war, the victors write the history, and that's the side you hear about? I don't think very many people have written about hairy hominoids in Africa. And if they have, it hasn't really escaped to the larger public outside of the continent. So maybe that's the problem.
I think you're right.
I texted Oscar. You remember our witness, Oscar, who was from South Africa. He saw Sasquatch over here outside of Welch's and Rhododendron here right up the road from me. We had him on the podcast here. He's from South Africa. So I reached out to him just today or yesterday on text, and I told him about the book since he seemed interested in the subject, and I thought he might get a kick out of it. And he told me he's going to pick up the book and read it as soon as he can.
Oh, right on. And you talked to another witness of ours, I remember, because he called me Sam, and I had him call you up there. That was a little ordeal.
Yeah. He gave me a call and sent along the photographs of the prints in the ground. Yeah, basically, long story short, he found a footprint on his driveway. He lives in Skamania County in a very, very, squotchy area, for lack of a better term. He found a footprint on his driveway in the snow and leaf litter one morning. This is what, about a week and a half ago, maybe, or 2 weeks ago at the most. And he took a couple pictures of it. You can see the pictures on my Facebook page. I threw one of them up there, you know, and then you told me about it and I got in touch with him and found his address, and I was working at the museum. So I had to wait until after work, but I was out there. I got out there around 7:30 at night. And by then the rain and the snow melts had really done a number on the footprints, but I was able to observe three of them in the ground. The original one that was photographed was still there, but you know, it was a little deceiving. The photographs of footprint tracks are almost always deceiving, actually. But this one, it looked like it might have some depth to it. But if there was any depth to this at all, it was maybe a third of a centimeter at the very most, and probably less in some places, you know, because it was on pea gravel. It was a pea gravel driveway. And the shape of the foot that you can see in the photograph is largely because the foot had disturbed a thin layer of leaf litter on the driveway. Ahead of it, there was another spot where you could see something damp, like, you know, did some damage to the ground, again, on the pea gravel driveway road thing. If I remember right, it was 42 or 43 inches, the step length. And then the previous footprint was more interesting because the heel, at least, impressed into the substrate that was partly off the road, and then the rest of it was on the gravel road. So, but it was very blobby and whatnot by the time I saw it. But yes, I got to see three of these things and hear stories about the weird sounds and the strange occurrences that have been happening around that property. And then, of course, I'd left them my personal phone number in case anything happens again, because they're always on the lookout.
Yeah. Well, they had those other prints too in the snow that he didn't even think about calling us for those ones, but I was glad he thought of us for the last ones, even if it didn't work out. It's at least we know there, because usually, dude, whenever I go to these ones, either it's totally indiscernible, or usually it's a bear or a person. And at least with him, we know they were really squash tracks.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And when you see the photograph too, they're, you know, they look pretty good. I got excited about them. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know what? I'm really getting sick of, you know how Google, if you have the Google thing on alert for Bigfoot or Sasquatch on your, you get the notices.
Oh yeah, the emails, right?
Yeah, it's like telling you like links to articles, like any kind of news article or.
Mm-hmm, that mentions it, like has that word in there somewhere.
I'm sick of that thing, man. They're just spreading hoaxes. It's just like a hoax spreading.
Yeah, well, we live in the world of fake news now, you know?
Well, this is real fake news.
Well, yeah, yeah, but it's slow news days, and then the media runs with the Bigfoot stuff, even if it is a, you know, big pile of crap.
I get so many messages whenever there's every fake story, every fake video. I get tons of, it's like, and then I heard that YouTube does not recommend any new Bigfoot videos because they've all been fake.
Where did you hear that?
I was talking to someone that knows the internet stuff real well, and they said, yeah, there's no more. It is, you know, when it pops up in your, like, if you, whatever you watch, like, you might want to watch these, you know, suggested videos, and they'll throw up, like, wow, surfing ones. And I used to get Bigfoot videos. I don't get any more. And I mentioned that to someone. They said, oh, yeah, YouTube no longer recommends Bigfoot videos because they're just all fake.
Huh. That's bizarre. Now, what if you just search for Bigfoot stuff and wouldn't say?
It just doesn't suggest it anymore.
Weird. We'll show them. Bunch of jerks.
Yeah, you know what? I talked to the legendary Tom Yammer on the Bob Dylan of Bigfoot Rock and Roll.
Yeah.
My old bandmate.
Mm-hmm.
We were discussing some things, and we started talking about the Ballad of Albert O.
Yeah, I love that song. I love the story in general. But what did Tom and you have to say about it?
Well, we were just talking about, I was saying, like, you know, I always thought it'd be one of the most compelling stories. And, like, for a long time, the best insight into Sasquatch culture, family groups, how they operate, because I always thought it was real. And John Green thought it was real. But John Freitas, who's one of my original mentors in the Bigfoot field, he, you know, is law enforcement, and he actually teaches how to detect deception from somebody. And he was convinced that Albert O was lying. He said his body language, this, you know, he was just like, he's absolutely lying. And I was so bummed to hear that. And I was talking to Yams about it today, and I said, yeah, Yams, you know, like, I still believe it's true, but I can't be so convinced 100% like I was, just because John is so insistent. He told me, yeah, well, John didn't base that on the whole article. He didn't see the whole interview. Like, he saw a 1 minute clip.
There's actually video of him talking, of him saying the story, talking about his account. There's film of that, really. I don't think I've ever seen that. I know there's a recording.
No, there's a whole thing's recorded, but I think there's a minute of footage, I thought.
I've never seen that.
Yeah, so there's like a quick clip, but for the audience that doesn't know, Albert Osman was a guy that went out and did some prospecting back in 1924 up in British Columbia in Canada, and he claimed to have been kidnapped by a family, well, by a large adult male Sasquatch, and brought back to a Sasquatch family in the interior.
Yeah, anybody familiar with the John Green books should know about this story already. Of course, and if you're listening to this podcast, chances are you're pretty familiar with the John Green books, or at least should be. Hint, hint, go get them and read them. Yeah, but Albert Osman was basically, he was on a vacation at the head of the Toba Inlet in British Columbia. That's north of Vancouver on the mainland. And one night he was picked up and carried a great distance by something, and he turned out it was a Sasquatch, who deposited him in this, I guess, box canyon, where a family of four of these things was hanging out. And he was there for 6 days, if I remember right. And during that time, he had a lot of close observations of Sasquatches, their anatomy, their behavior. And at the end of it all, he apparently slipped one some snuff, which made it sick, and he escaped and made his way out to civilization. On the surface, you know, when I read this for the first time, I think in the early 90s or something like that, or probably was aware of it earlier than that, but when I really started reading Bigfoot stuff to learn instead of just for entertainment, I was thinking, maybe. It seemed pretty far-fetched. And even today, I got to say that this is one of those cases that I'm willing to say, I don't know. I just don't know if it's true or not. It might be. If it is, it's significant. Maybe some of it's true and some of it's not. or maybe none of it is true, because there are some problems with the story after all.
Mm-hmm.
Not just behavioral problems, you know, like the Sasquatches in the story. They had a lot of ape-like behaviors and strange interactions. They had a little language thing going on. They would talk to each other. Now, I don't have any problem with any of that. What I do have a little bit of a problem is their sleeping area was reported to have had a bed of loosely woven cedar boughs in which had been like interwoven moss and whatnot as a blanket. See, and I think that's problematic to say that these things weave blankets.
Yeah, what happened with Albert Ostman was he was prospecting looking for some gold or whatever. And he was hiking. He canoe paddled way up into this inlet, Toba Inlet.
Uh-huh.
And he went hiking up into the mountains. And then after a couple nights, he had one come in and ransack his – well, something came into his camp and ransacked. He's like, what the hey? And then he was worried about his boot. He thought, was it porcupines? Because he was worried about the porcupines eating his leather boots. So he put his boots in his sleeping bag and his tins of snuff and some food, some like canned peaches or something like that, whatever. He had some canned food. Then his rifle and a box of shells. And I think it's flint or matches or something. He had something to make fire. And in the middle of the night, he just got picked up and slung like he was like Santa carrying a bag of toys, slung him over his shoulder and started walking. He made some interesting observations, which I've personally heard the way they breathe like that sometimes, where it sounds like they got a cold or they're out of breath. And he mentions the thing that sounded like, it sounded congested kind of, and it was carrying him up there and it dropped him off in that canyon. And then there was a female adult and then two, what he interpreted to be teenager juveniles, like the male about 7 foot and a female about six and a half foot, I think.
Yeah.
And he got the impression from the gestures and what they were doing was that they wanted him to mate with the female, the young female, the teenage girl.
Well, you know, that isn't in the John Green description. And I heard somewhere that was left out. But what is the source of that?
You know, I still don't remember who told me this. I remember someone told me like 20 years ago. It might have been Dmitry Bayanov or someone told me.
I've heard that as well, but I hang out with you a lot. I might have heard that from you. So I'd like to get, nothing personal. I'd like to get an independent source. Like, where did that come from? Because I reread the John Green's version not long ago, and it's not in there. But I also know that John Green, was a man of his time, and he got rather prudish perhaps in some ways because he's a journalist, and there's just some things that, God-fearing people just don't put in, in print. I guess we can put it out to the listeners. If you guys know of the source, the primary source of that, we'd both love to hear about it. So yeah, shoot us an email or something.
Yeah. And we were talking about the snuff. He would, when he was done with the can of snuff, he'd give it to the adult male, the big one, like the 8 foot or whatever, and it would lick it and get all the extra little tidbits. And on his last final day, sixth day, he'd also give him like the coffee grounds. He liked the coffee grounds. He used coffee grounds. And he gave him a whole can of snuff, and he might have gave him 2 cans, for sure 1 can, and he ate the whole thing, and his stomach started, he just watched the things, eyes get all weird, like it was like, uh-oh, just ate a whole can of snuff, and then it grabbed the pitcher of hot coffee and tried to drink that to get some liquid in, and it scalded his mouth, and it ran off, and then he grabbed his rifle and made a run for the canyon had a little gap, like just shoulder-width gap in between the rocks to get out, and the female, he said, it was shaped real pear-shaped, which you'll see if you ever get a chance to see Dennis Foles, not thermal, but just, night scope video that he filmed of the female walking away. It really reminded me of that Albert Ostman story, how they're kind of apple-shaped with big wide hips and kind of a duck walk. And he said that she started sprinting towards to block the exit, and he fired a shot over her head with his 30-30, and she screamed and ran, turned around and ran off, and he ran down the hill and they never pursued him or came after him. But yeah, he made some great observations about them climbing the cliffs, the young male, how dexterous it was up there. It was like a monkey in a tree, the way it was going up and down these cliffs. And he also made some notes about them eating like the roots of sweet grasses from the water plants. And I think Jeff's Relic Hominid Inquiry Group, I'm pretty sure they refer to that.
Oh, yeah, basically the underside of the foot, the plantar surface of the foot, right?
Yeah, they refer to it. I know I've seen it referred to in some of those scientific writings is Ostman's Pad, since he described that.
Well, you know, that's one of the things about the Albert Ostman story that's kind of always makes me wonder about the truthfulness of it, not doubting it, because I kind of doubt it, obviously, because there's things on both sides I find compelling. Like, yeah, this is clearly nonsense, or yeah, this clearly happened to him. And what the more compelling things about the story are the anatomical details. He did comment in John Green's version of the story how the underside of the foot looks like almost like it was the underside of a dog's foot, you know, like that kind of skin underneath. And which is interesting because about 2 years ago, I read this study in this journal, I forget which one, and it was about dog feet. I guess one of the mysteries of dogs was, why is it that dogs that run on ice all day, why is it that their feet don't freeze? And it has to do with the unique structure of the pad of their foot and all these capillaries that are constantly shoving blood through and whatever else. And then I immediately thought of the Albert Ostman story. Because if superficially on the outside of the surface, if they both look similar, maybe Sasquatches have something like that going as well, because they also would live in such frigid conditions. You'd have to wonder why their feet don't freeze to some degree. Maybe they're equipped with the same sort of adaptation.
Yeah, there's a lot. Well, any mammal would have to have something like that on their foot. But there's
yeah, you think so.
You know, I know when you see like those natives that never wear shoes ever.
Yeah.
Their feet thick, those calluses and pads on the bottom of their feet, they can get like a quarter inch thick, no problem.
You know, Albert Ostman also made some observations about how the big toe, the hallux, was longer than the rest of the toes. And of course, that's a individual variation sort of thing, because there are good examples from the Sasquatch footprint data set of Morton's foot, where the second digit is longer than the hallux. But in this case, he noticed like it'd be like good for mountain climbing and whatnot. But you know, when I was rereading it, something that struck me at this read, because I haven't read it in many years now, you know, probably a decade or something, and I didn't know as much about, say, Sasquatch hands at the time when I read it last time. But this time he commented about how the fingers were shorter and squatter than they seemed like they should be, and how the hands themselves are very wide, and it just resonated so accurately with what we now know about Sasquatch hands. And so those small little details, like if this whole escapade didn't happen to him, how does he know about all these details? But yet there are inconsistencies in the story too.
Yeah. Where how he paddled out and his story doesn't make sense about, but you know, oh, you know what? Duh. At the Hocking Hills Bigfoot conference with B. Mills this year, John Kirk gave a great talk. We got to get John Kirk on here, dude.
Oh, really?
Dude, he gave a like hour and a half talk on Albert Ostman and his story. And, you know, John Kirk, he's a law enforcement guy. He's a, you know, detective type guy. And he is so thorough in his research. I mean, dude, he dug so deep on this Ostman story. He's convinced it's real now. He met people by chance that knew Ostman back in the 60s and 70s. I mean, John went to like San Francisco where Albert had been born, I guess, and lived there for a while. And he went, tracked down Ostman's widow and all kinds of stuff. And he had so much documentation about where Albert was working at the time and everything. He couldn't prove that his story was real, but everything Albert else he had said rang true. And he also got to speak to two people that knew Ostman. He talked to one old timer that knew Albert back at that time that worked with him on the job site and said, yeah, he came and then he left. He was like, he moved back to Washington State. And I'll get John Kirk on here and he is impressed at how much he researched it. And he met someone else. Like, I think it was a woman that was a waitress that knew him or something that he used to come in, and he had told her that story before.
Well, you know, that's one of the things about the Ostman story that is problematic, is that he didn't tell his, like, that the whole occurrence happened in 1924, but he didn't tell anybody until 1957. Well, he wrote it down. Luckily, he wrote it down, I don't know when, but decades before 1957. So that exists, or existed at least, but he didn't really go public with it until I think it was a centennial of British Columbia or Canada, if I remember right. And there was a big celebration in Harrison Hot Springs, or if I remember right, is that it? This is approximately accurate. Double check me on this one, all you listeners out there. But there was something going on in Harrison Hot Springs, maybe that great Sasquatch hunt that John Green was part of publicizing and all that stuff. But that's when he decided to tell the story, when he saw that people were getting attention about the Bigfoot thing. So that's always been problematic. But when John Green is writing in his book, Sasquatch Apes Among Us, the last sentence in that chapter, here, I have it in front of me here, I'm going to read it. In 1969, however, an old friend of mine told me that he had first heard of the Sasquatch in the early 1930s from a trapper at Toba Inlet who said he knew a young Swede who claimed to have been carried off by one. Well, that's Albert Ostman.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Albert Ostman was a Swede. And like, who else in Toba Inlet has ever claimed that, right? So like, the story existed in the early 1930s. According to John Green's source. So that's compelling too.
Yeah. Oh, and Renee DeHinden interviewed him, and Renee DeHinden's widow was, she was afterwards, he died. Just about 7-8 years ago, she came to a Bigfoot conference, and she was there when Renee interviewed Albert Ostman. And she was like from his home, the same hometown as Albert Ostman, or the same little province or whatever. Mm-hmm. So they hit it off real, real well. And she said her and Renee were both absolutely convinced that he was telling the truth.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, you know, the other problems, though, with the story, are one of them is geographic.
Yeah. Should have could see the mountains and the volcano and all that.
Yeah, I think he said Mount Baker, but that's not even, you wouldn't be able to see that there. There's another, but you know, maybe it just has the wrong name of a, you know, a mountain. There's plenty of big old volcano mountains there because it's the Cascades, and yeah, that's how the Cascades were made. But even then, where he said he came out versus where he said he went in, that's like 60 or 80 miles away from each other.
Yeah.
And he wasn't, you know, when he was carried for, Albert Austin's best guess is that he was carried in his sleeping bag for 3 hours that night.
Yeah.
So the distance thing is really problematic, unless he just has some stuff dead wrong.
Right. Oh, you know what else? John Kirk went and pulled all the logging records and found the company that Albert said that he met up with that rescued him.
Mm, yeah.
They were logging where Albert said they were.
Wow. I certainly have a lot to learn about the new happenings, I guess, in the Albert Ostman story. But sounds like we should probably maybe put a pin in this and try to get John Kirk on in the next few weeks or so.
You know what else I forgot to bring up, Cliff, when we were just talking about the Sasquatch type things in Africa, is that new ghost DNA, kind of human DNA they found in West African populations. They made it with an unknown hominid race 50,000 years ago.
Right. Yeah, I heard something about that in the news. What did you read about it?
Well, they analyzed the genomes of like 400 West Africans from like Sierra Leone and I think Guinea. So I know Sierra Leone was one of them. That wet where Africa sticks out to the west above Congo where it comes out.
Uh-huh.
Analyzed it. They had like 400 of them, and they found they call it ghost DNA, where it's not modern human DNA, and they'd never found this before. And it was unique to Africans, and they were mixing, they don't know how far back, but it stopped about 50,000 years ago. And I was wondering if that could be help explain what's going on with these sightings.
Well, you know what? I think that in Africa, we should expect to have more than one species. If you know, I think that we're far enough away from a lot of these things that we won't be able to successfully interbreed. So if something was breeding with us 50,000 years ago, we know that Neanderthals did that. We know that Denisovans did that same thing, but they're pretty recent, you know, hominins. And so let me ask you this, because I didn't read the article, but I guess I should. Could they differentiate the ghost DNA from both Neanderthals and Denisovans?
I don't know. They split off from the ancestors of modern humans a little before Neanderthals split off. Up north.
We're going to be seeing a lot more of this in the future, because now that we can actually sequence the DNA of extinct hominins like Neanderthals or Denisovans, we're going to start seeing little segments of their DNA in our own that proves that we've been interbreeding for some time. Because remember, the Denisovans were literally discovered by their DNA. we had a finger bone from a cave in Russia somewhere, just a finger bone segment. And they tested, it was fossilized, but they tested the DNA of that. And they said, holy crap, this is a new species. And since then, we've been finding other little pieces of bones and fossils or whatever of the same Denisovan. So literally that whole species is best known by their DNA. We have no skeletons from them. We have a jawbone, which is also an interesting story. I don't know if you caught that or not. But a Denisovan jawbone was discovered in an unlikely place, at least that's what it would seem to be, in a museum. It had been incorrectly identified as something else, maybe Heidelbergensis or something like that. But turns out it was Denisovan. So we already had one, but we didn't know. We had this mandible of a Denisovan since, I think, the mid-'80s, if my memory serves. And we didn't even know it.
Yeah, well, they used to say, oh, this DNA, like it's human DNA. I was like, well, how do you know what we call human DNA? How do you know that wasn't something else that got mixed in with us so far back? We just call it human now, but it really came, but now they can tell the difference.
Yeah. The science is beyond me. That's one of those things I should probably learn more about. But God, there's just so much else to do besides becoming a pseudo expert on DNA when there's other people that already are.
Right. I just try to have an understanding of it on some level.
Yeah. I mean, I have my biology classes in college and whatever, but beyond that, it's all letters to me.
Yeah.
Well, it's an exciting time, you know? And when we look at that, the Beyond the Secret Elephants book that we were mentioning earlier, one of the sightings you mentioned was that they were smaller, right? That might fit really, really well into the Australopithecine framework, you know, the model, because they were relatively small, like 4 feet tall for the most part. Maybe they were relict Australopithecines. The Otung, one of the accounts had it at 7 feet tall or so. So that doesn't fit very well in the Australopithecines, at least as we know them from the fossil record. But if Sasquatches are Paranthropus, as I suspect they might be, that just shows that species could get bigger. And it probably did, you know, maybe that's what we're dealing with. So, or maybe some unknown Australopithecine or Paranthropus that was larger to begin with. That would be an earth shaker, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's totally possible.
Totally possible. Yeah, I think I picked this up from Meldrum, but I'm not sure. Gosh, my memory is just so lousy, you know, about details like that. But I believe that the number is something like less than, scientists currently think they have less than 2% of the fossilized species on record so far. Have you found what you think is Sasquatch scat, Bobo?
Yeah, I for sure did. It was right in a track line. It was coming up and raiding the rat traps that had juju fruits in them.
And where and when? Let's start with that. Where and when, and then set it up.
This was at Orleans down by the base of right where you turn up to go to, where you go left to go to Bluff Creek up the Go Road.
Uh-huh.
We just went straight for another half mile and hung a right on Red Cap and went across Red Cap Road down Red Cap Creek up Red Cap, the last property on Red Cap Creek. By the way, Red Cap Creek is where the Creek Indians up there, the local tribe, they're the neighbors of the Yuroks and Hoopas that people are more familiar with. They said that's Red Cap Creek up there is where their creation story for with the hairy man, whatever, Sasquatch, is in the headwaters of Red Cap Creek. And it's also where Peter Byrne found that nest in his book, where he says it was the best piece of evidence he found in North America, that nest, was up that same creek. And my buddy bought the property. It had been abandoned for 11 years. And there was Bigfoots living on the property, at least part of the time, a family of four. We saw the eyes shine from all four of them one night. Anyways, found scat, three different piles there. And it was, you know, the big pile was, you know, almost the size of a Coke can. The smaller pile was like the size of a Red Bull can. But the one you could, it was that one I told you about where where you could see where it was walking through the tall grass and all that, and walked through some dust. But then it walked through a burn pile that had really fine ash in it. There was two perfect 14, like 3/4 inch tracks, like just looked like the Grace Harbor cast or something, you know? And but it was real, it was in real fine ash. And it walked over to the, where some rat traps were. And we theorized that, that it, when it was reaching for the candy, it got snapped, the trap went off and got him. Because then it straddled the trap and took a huge, huge pile right on top of it.
And what became of that pile, if anything?
That's the, some of the ones that I brought to the fishing game office and drop off saying, get this analyzed. I think it's Bigfoot scat. And remember then my buddy got a job there and a couple years later and I said, hey, whatever happened, find out what happened to my scat samples. And he's looking and goes, that was you? They told us about some big crazy guy coming with his own piles of huge crap and tell him it's Bigfoot, get it analyzed. And they just threw it in the trash.
Awesome. Awesome.
The 2004 expedition in where I had my best sighting ever on the Hickory Apache Reservation down there in the Squatch bedding area, we found that's the thing that was weird. They peed where they'd been laying down. They peed and pooped right in their little bedding area in the middle of it.
Really?
Yeah. Those dirt beds where they just cleared, like they cleared everything, like all the sticks, twigs, leaves, whatever that was there. And they'd make these like oval shaped spots in the dirt that were just out in the open. And they appeared to have slept there. And then when they got up, they peed and pooped right in their sleep spots. We found two different days where they'd slept the night before like that, where we found their scat.
Weird. You know, I heard that from another investigator in Kentucky, that where he thinks that these things were lying down, they would clear out all the leaf litter and twigs and whatnot from the forest floor to go down to the dirt and then sleep on that.
Yeah. Yep. I've heard that from other people.
Wild. Okay, cool. Yeah, I didn't even think about that until just right now when you're describing that.
But it's a summer thing.
Right, when you're just sleeping with the sheet, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And in their case, they sheet in it afterwards.
Yep. Classic.
Yeah, I'm not sure I've ever found Sasquatch poop. I've taken some pictures of some big turds out in the woods, but I can't say any of them are not bear. But, you know, trying to diligently document. Somebody has brought poop into the museum now, by the way. It was just a matter of time till that was going to happen. Somebody came in with one of those small igloo coolers and opened it up, and there's dry ice in there and everything else, and a big turd. Looking closely at the turd, as closely as I dare, I've determined that is almost certainly bear crap. But, you know, at least they're trying.
Was it a German tourist that brought it in?
No, it was someone interested in the subject that ran across something weird. So a potential citizen scientist. I don't know of their descent, but they weren't German. Weren't wearing dolphin shorts and, you know, all that sort of stuff, which Germans may or may not do.
Right. They do that.
Well, you know, I only say that because I sometimes reflect back to the stay in Yellowstone that I had way back in the day. And I was there sleeping at a backpacker's site, you know, in one of those side little places, because I just got done backpacking for a few nights out in a wilderness area in Yellowstone. And so it was the first night back, and I got out of the tent one morning and looked across the meadow, and I saw something caught my eye in the meadow, and I go, oh my God. And it was like a shark fin going across, this brown shark fin. And I went, no way. And sure enough, a few moments later, I see this big grizzly bear come out of the grass, jump into the river, swim across the river about 15, 20 feet, hop out on the other side, and then keep on going through the meadow with this, you know, his hump right above the grass line. And it was running towards the campground. And I'm thinking, oh my God. And luckily it was like about 70 or 80 yards away from where I was. That's where it was aiming towards. And so this thing runs into the campground and, you know, about 70 yards away from me, and goes and starts sniffing around all these, you know, picnic tables and stuff. And people are honking their horns and yelling at the bear, but several people were in dolphin shorts, clearly Europeans of some sort, were trying to get closer to it and take pictures of it. And they were like 15 feet away as this thing's going through the snacks on, you know, morning breakfast tables. I just couldn't believe it, but I guess, you know, they don't have grizzly bears there. I mean, they have brown bears in Russia and stuff, but you'd think they'd know better than to approach something like that so closely.
Dude, people are stupid, but it's amazing. There's black bears all over. I didn't know, like, Iran and Iraq have a subspecies of black bear.
Hmm.
There's, like, India has them. I mean, up in the Himalayas. I mean, there's so many places that have brown bears, you know, basically grizzlies around the world. I was surprised to find out how many, like Turkey and even Syria.
Well, you know, I hear about these relictominoid reports from places like Afghanistan and places like that. So I figured there must be huge tracts of, you know, largely vacant forest land if they have, you know, Bigfoot-like reports out there. So it makes sense that bears would be there too.
Yeah, for sure.
That might be one of those commonalities that we did not notice in on finding Bigfoot as we went abroad and went to places like Australia and Vietnam and wherever else, China. Because some of the things I noticed on our travels, some of the commonalities is that wherever we went for Bigfoot, there were, or Bigfoot-like animals, there were ferns. In every single case, there were ferns, even in South Dakota, where it's quite hot and whatnot. I wouldn't think like a plant like that would do well, but they were there too. And also rhododendrons were a pretty common theme as well. Even in like China, I remember the prevalence of rhododendrons out into – it looked just like the Pacific Northwest.
It did, yeah. Now, I think we thought that ferns were a common denominator for sure.
But black bears might be another one that we just didn't run across because black bears are also very elusive.
Or brown bears.
Oh, bears in general, right?
Right.
Bears are there, then certainly other things could be making a living.
Right, for sure, yeah. Because people kill bears.
Right.
It's going to be pretty wild for grizzlies to coexist or brown bears to coexist with people. It's got to be pretty remote.
Sure. Did you fart?
No.
What was that? You did. I can tell by your voice.
Chair squeaking.
Is that what it is? It's that chilly.
Trying to be classy, Cliff.
You did it on Finding Bigfoot all the time, and that had more viewers than our show has listeners.
Dude, I don't know what happened, but I saw like a 5 or 6 minute clip video of just all these clips where they're me farting on camera. there's a couple of good ones where you see Renee's face just contort in a horror and just head turn away in disgust.
Well, everybody loves a good fart joke, except Renee when she's out there with you.
They had to have, if they would have totaled all the times I farted on camera, they'd have, if they just spliced it all together in one continuous sound file, it would be several hours.
Oh, it'd be at least one complete episode.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, 43 and a half minutes of Bobo farts. Yeah, that's doable.
Easily. Yeah, we were eating a lot of weird food. I mean, not weird, but truck stop food and fast food and all that stuff. So definitely had some prominent flatulence.
Well, there were some questionable meals in there. Like, what about that cold episode when we brought our family members out in North Carolina, I think it was?
Yeah.
Remember the turkey? It had air bubbles in it.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, you remember that. Yeah, remember that, right? Because like we started eating it, and we all just were like, "What?" And then they said, "Screw it!" They went out to like Burger King or somewhere like that and got everybody burgers because we had to eat, and we weren't going to eat turkey with air bubbles in it.
Right. That was one.
Must have just been like mushed up. Like they must have just ground up a bunch of turkeys or something, and then made this mushy goo, and then froze it. And like made it a solid again somehow and then sold it as that. But, you know, I got to say, they fed us pretty good.
Oh, I'm not complaining. Yeah, for the most part, it was great.
Yeah, better than I usually eat some, you know, if I'm cooking. Bobo, do you have anything coming up? Any events you're going to be doing, some appearances or anything like that coming up?
You know what? They just announced, I guess, yesterday that I was going to be with you at that event in mid-March up in Oregon.
Okay, yeah.
But I'm not going to be able to make it because I got to go visit parents that same weekend. Yep, so I'm gonna have to miss that thing. So you'll be there. What's it called again? It's
on the Mackenzie River. It's a benefit in Mackenzie Bridge. I don't know where I'm speaking, and I don't know how people would find out about it. But if you look up, you know, Cliff Berkman Mackenzie Bridge, and March 13th and 14th, you can learn about it. And it's a benefit, and that's why I'm doing it. It's because I believe all the proceeds of this go to the school district down there, because it's a really small, underfunded school district. And one of the only good things about fame, I guess, is doing good for other people, you know? And sometimes you get an opportunity to help out a small community like this. And
cool. Well, shoot, Cliff. Next time we get together and chat, you got to let me know how it goes.
sounds like we're gonna have some great guests in the next couple episodes too. So looking forward to the next conversation we have.
Right on, Cliff. All right. Well, thanks, brother.
All right, Bubs, man. Always a pleasure. I'll speak to you soon.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Bigfoot and Beyond. If you liked what you heard, please rate and review us on iTunes. Subscribe to Bigfoot and Beyond wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Bigfoot and Beyond Podcast. You can find us on Twitter at Bigfoot and Beyond, that's an N in the middle, and tweet us your thoughts and questions with the hashtag Bigfoot and Beyond.
All right, this is the Ballad of Albert O.
Well, we've all been out camping. It's a fun place to go. Some go in groups, some go alone. Some go to the mountains, some even camp in the snow. But no one's had a camping trip like old Albert O. Well, he took a vacation to do some prospecting for gold. Rode the boat to Toba Inlet, was a good place he was told. His Indian guide warned him about the Sasquatch, but Albert ignored him, saying, "You drank too much scotch." Willie hiked into the woods, for 3 days all was fine. The day 4 came along, and things began to unwind. His backpack was ransacked, he lost his flour and prunes. He would wait up for this critter by the light of the moon. Well, he waited and waited, but his eyelids, they closed. He was snatched up in his sleeping bag, but still Albert dozed. He woke up in a bundle, couldn't grab for his knife. Albert Osman was in for the ride of his life. Them Sasquatch make you one of the family. Albert, oh, Albert, what do you say? You're not on this Sasquatch, you got carried away.
Well, he was carried up and over a 3 ridges, it seemed. If he wasn't in such pain, you would have thought it was a dream. He got dumped in a heap, and he rolled to a stop. When he opened his eyes, well, his jaw had just dropped. Well, there standing before him was a family of 4. And no, my dear friends, it wasn't the family next door. It was 4 hairy giants, and they gave off a smell. Albert Osman had been carried to where the Sasquatch did dwell. Well, he was trapped in a small valley, made the best of his stay. He watched the dad sit around while the kids, they did play. They had a bed of moss and leaves, he had his knapsack and boots. He dined on cold hash, and they dined on sweet roots. And very much like a step figure and covered in hair, where their feet and fingernails did rightly compare. Could have sworn they were wild men, they didn't use language or tools. Nah, these were the Sasquatch, they didn't fit any rules. Albert, oh, Albert, what did you see? Them Sasquatch made you one of a family. Albert, oh, Albert, what do you say? You not only saw Sasquatch, you got carried away. Well, this went on for 6 days, and Albert said that's enough. He would make the big one sick by feeding him snuff. Well, he rolled him the can, and Daddy B ate it all. Albert grabbed up his things and ran for the hole in the wall. Well, he shot at the mama, who tried to halt his escape, and ran as fast as he could to get free from these apes. After 2 days, he found some loggers. They said, "What happened to you?" Well, he thought about telling them. They never believe it was true. So Albert went home. 'Twas 1924, and kept his tale to himself for 30 years or more. And then he talked to John Green about his week there in hell. He made him swear for the judge it was the truth he did tell. Well, he went looking for some gold to enrich his life, but he almost ended up with a hairy Bigfoot wife. So if you go out camping, don't go where he did go, or you might just end up like old Alberto. Alberto, Albert, what did you see? Them Sasquatch made you one of a family. Alberto, Albert, what did you say? You're not only a Sasquatch, you got carried away. Sasquatch made you one of the family. Albert, oh Albert, what do you say? You're not only Sasquatch.